This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Chelsea Girls by Fiona Davis. Read for you by Kirsten Potter and Hilary Huber. For the artists whose dreams were lost. Prologue. New York City, March 1967. In the dead of night, during the dreary month of March, the Chelsea Hotel is a quiet place. The only sound that cuts through the silence is the squeal of a police siren, and that fades fast. Thick walls keep out the everyday noises of one's neighbors, the muffled swears after walking into a bedpost with a bare foot, or the generous moans of lovemaking. The ghosts of the Chelsea hide in the cement-filled brick walls during the day and glide out during the violet hours to keep watch. Over time, their number has accumulated, from the refined gentlewoman who left behind four diamond rings to the puffy Welsh poet sinking from alcoholic stupor to coma. The musicians chant quietly with vaporous breath as the former owner hovers mutely by, wringing his hands with worry. One more to come very soon. If the woman had more courage, she might jump from the roof. That would be the faster method, instead of this slow slide into oblivion, where every so often a futile panic makes her want to call out, cry for help. But no one would hear. Not here. The ghosts jeer at her and point, but she knows they'll eventually welcome her into the fold. And once she's gone, she too will keep watch over the residents, including her one true friend, who will sigh into her pillow as the apparition leans in close for an invisible kiss.
Act 1. Chapter 1. Hazel. Naples, Italy, April 1945. She hated Maxine Mead and Italy on first sight. When Hazel had first auditioned for the USO tour back in New York, she'd imagined arriving abroad and gingerly stepping off a plane to a cheering group of GIs. The stage would be a grand opera house or something similarly picturesque, like what she'd seen in the newsreels of Marlene Dietrich and Bob Hope entertaining the troops. Hazel would be sure to call them men, not boys, as the USO Actor's Handbook advised. After all, many of them had been fighting for 4 years now. They deserved respect, as well as some wholesome entertainment, a respite from the fighting. Upon boarding the Air Corps plane at LaGuardia Airport, Hazel was informed that she'd be replacing a member of an all-female acting troupe who'd come down with jaundice. Not until the noisy tin can of a cargo plane was aloft was she told her destination, Naples, Italy. After a bumpy landing, Hazel lugged her two suitcases off the plane and stood on the tarmac, exhausted and confused, waiting for someone to tell her where to go, what to do next. The stifling heat was made worse by the fact that she'd been given the winter uniform, including wool stockings and thick winter panties. Every inch of her from the waist down itched as though she had ants crawling up her sweaty legs. Her uniform, a greenish-gray skirt, white blouse, long black tie, and garrison cap that she'd admired in the mirror back in New York, was now a stinking, wrinkled mess. Finally, a soldier pulled up in a jeep and called out her name. He tossed her suitcases in the back before helping her into the passenger seat. They lurched off over a road battered by potholes, passing demolished apartment buildings and churches. Several women picked through a pile of garbage by the side of the road, stopping to stare at Hazel with dead eyes before turning back to their work. A group of ragged, emaciated children, one of whom sucked on his dirty fingers, watched the scavengers. Yet across the street, a tidy line of schoolboys walked past the desolation as if nothing were wrong. The air smelled of rotting vegetables. Dust kicked into Hazel's nose and made her sneeze. Early in the war, the newspapers had published aerial photos of the city that showed almost all of it up in smoke, annihilated by relentless bombing. While many of the inhabitants sought safety deep underground in the ancient Roman aqueducts and tunnels, at least 20,000 people had been killed. She tried to envision what it would be like if New York had been similarly decimated, she and her mother out with their shopping bags, stepping over chunks of concrete, going about their day. She couldn't imagine it. "This is terrible. There's hardly anything left," she said. The driver shrugged. "Naples was the most bombed site in Italy. The residents rose up and resisted the Germans, right?" She tried to remember what she'd read in the papers. "Looks like they paid dearly for it."
"Sure did."
He made a sharp left off the main road. "They told me to take you directly to the stage." She would have thought they'd give her a moment or two to freshen up after her interminable trip. "Is the acting company rehearsing?"
"Nope, it's a show."
He nodded at the men trudging along the side of the road in the same direction, smoking cigarettes.
"This is your audience."
At the sound of a low rumble above them, every helmeted head snapped up, scouring the skies. But it was only thunder, from a slate-colored cloud to the west, far out over the sea. The helmets snapped back down. A show. Good. She'd have a chance to watch the other actors. In New York, she'd been given the script for Blithe Spirit, which had been a big hit on Broadway 4 years earlier, along with instructions to learn the maid's role, and she had managed to memorize some of the lines during the flight. The lines were the easy part for Hazel, as she'd been a serial understudy for the past few years. Hazel's hope, when she first auditioned for the USO, was to be able to break out of her understudy rut and finally act on stage in a real performance. This was her chance to try something new, so that when she returned to New York, she'd be taken seriously as a major actress, not just a backup to be called upon when the leading lady got the flu, which, with Hazel's bad luck, had never happened. She'd even established a reputation among producers. Hiring Hazel Ripley as an understudy guaranteed that your leading lady would never miss a show. 20 plays now under her belt without going on even once. Every night she'd feel a guilty flicker of relief as the star flounced through the stage door, healthy and raring to go. But Hazel attributed her own reticence to her lack of experience. Surely once she'd gotten a taste of performing in front of an audience, she'd become just as competitive and eager to take center stage as her brother and father had been. She was a Ripley, after all. Her mother, Ruth, thought that joining the USO tour was a terrible idea, listing off the names of entertainers who had been injured or killed while abroad, usually in plane crashes. And let's not forget that pretty Jane Froman, who almost lost both legs when her plane crashed into a river in Portugal, Ruth had said. Accidents happen all the time. You know that's true. Hazel had changed the subject fast, recognizing the dangerous quiver in Ruth's voice. But she remained undeterred. The opportunity to get on stage while supporting her country was too good to pass up, and she viewed it as a way to honor her brother's memory while, at the same time, stepping out of his shadow. Not to mention, the pay was $10 a day plus meals. She'd filled out a long questionnaire, had her fingerprints taken, and gotten inoculated for diseases she'd never even heard of. And now, finally, she'd arrived. The jeep pulled into an enormous field where Mount Vesuvius could be seen smoking away in the distance. Soldiers had taken seats on long benches facing a truck. One side of the truck bed was folded down to expose a platform furnished with a small table and four chairs. A drab olive canopy was strung overhead. A flag hung from one side with the words USO Camp Shows written in blue on a white background. This was the stage, although it couldn't be more than 15 feet wide. A few hundred soldiers milled about, chatting and smoking cigarettes, with hundreds more still making their way across the field. "Over there." The driver pointed behind the truck, where a large tent had been erected. "That's where the performers are." He helped her out and handed her the two suitcases. One held the remaining dastardly uniform and other sundries, while the other was full of her best dresses. The actor's handbook had listed a series of do's and don'ts. For the stage, bring dresses that you'd wear on an important Saturday night date. Travel as a unit at all times.
If you behave properly, you'll increase your chance of making the better tours and improve your living and feeding conditions. Made them sound like livestock, that last one. I'd walk you in, but we're not allowed inside. The driver's neck turned red at the very idea. Good luck.
No, don't say that.
The soldier's eyebrows knitted together with concern.
What?
You're supposed to say, break a leg.
He broke out in a wide smile.
Right. Break a leg. Hazel nodded goodbye and slid through the opening in the tent flap backward, awkwardly maneuvering her suitcases inside.
Well, it's about time.
Hazel blinked, her eyes adjusting to the dark interior. A woman around her age, with hair the color of fire, did a slow turn, the better to show off a curvy figure that oozed out of a green silk dress. Behind her, three women perched on low stools in front of a splintered mirror, applying the final touches of stage makeup. The redhead's lip curled.
Hazel Ripley, where the hell have you been?
At least she knew she was in the right place.
I came straight from the plane.
She shrugged, lifting the suitcases a couple of inches to prove it.
Get out of that and into something pretty. They just called 10.
I'm sorry?
They just called 10 minutes. That means it's 10 minutes until showtime.
The redhead took a dramatic pause.
Have you ever even acted before?
I swear, jaundiced Jenny is out, and in her place we get Hayseed Hazel. The other women giggled. Hazel stood tall.
I've acted before. I know what it means, but I can't go on.
Why not? This must be some kind of joke they played on all the newbies.
Because I haven't rehearsed and don't know any of the blocking.
She put down her suitcases and brushed the dust off her skirt, realizing as she did so that it made her seem like a prissy schoolmarm. She let her arms fall to her sides.
You're the maid. How hard can it be? Do you know your lines?
I studied them on the plane.
Then you'll be fine. Just enter and exit when you're supposed to.
A voice came from outside the tent. Miss Mead?
Yes,
the redhead called back.
Someone to see you.
She looked at her watch.
Hayseed, get some makeup on and get out of that uniform. See you ladies in the wings.
Hazel waited a beat. Surely these women would all burst into laughter now that the joke had been played out. But they just turned back to the mirror. The redhead seemed familiar. Maybe Hazel had seen her in a show or at an audition back in New York.
Who is that? She asked.
That's Maxine Mead, our fearless leader.
The speaker, a tall brunette fitted out in a lemon-yellow dress, stood and shook Hazel's hand, introducing herself in a deep alto as Verna.
Do we have a leader?
Hazel was still waiting for an acknowledgement of the prank.
I thought we were all second lieutenants.
Maxine runs the show.
Verna shrugged and introduced the other two ladies. Phyllis was a rotund milkmaid type with rosy cheeks, and Betty Lou was a tiny slip of a girl, perfect for playing kids' parts, most likely.
She's joking, right, about me going on?
Verna shook her head.
No, we've been holding the curtain waiting for you. You can get ready over there.
But this was ridiculous. No rehearsal at all? Hazel didn't even know which actress was playing which character. A lump lodged in her throat at the thought of all those men out there waiting for the entertainment to begin. This had been a terrible idea. She'd be put on the next plane home, back to doing crosswords in the understudy's dressing room. Trembling, Hazel changed into one of her plainer dresses, as befitting a maid, and tied the apron Verna tossed over around her waist. She turned away so the other girls wouldn't see her hands shaking as she looped the ends into a bow. After standing in the wings for countless shows watching others perform, this would be the first time she'd actually step onto the stage, before thousands of people, with no rehearsal? She yanked the script out of her bag and leafed through the first scene, trying to imprint the cues in her head. The words swam around on the page as her heart pounded in her ribcage. Another loud clap of thunder.
Will they cancel if it rains?
You kidding? Said Phyllis. Some of these men walked miles to get here. They ain't going anywhere.
Hazel followed the other girls behind the big truck. The rain was holding off, but probably not for long, judging from the soggy feel in the air.
Hazel longed for a bolt of lightning to hit the truck and cancel the show. Anything to not have to go on stage in front of this sea of men in a strange country when she hadn't eaten or slept in what felt like a week. She waited in the wings, which was really a small set of stairs that led on stage, forcing back tears. Betty Lou handed her a tarnished silver tray. "Here's your prop." Hazel couldn't even whisper anything back. By then, her throat had closed up. She'd wanted desperately to act in a play, but not like this. Even worse, her character had the first entrance. The lights went up. She couldn't go out there, into the spotlight. What are you waiting for? A solid shove from Maxine, who'd silently reappeared, propelled her up the stairs. Hazel placed the tray on a table downstage as Verna entered from the other side. Hazel had no idea what Verna said. Her mind had fuzzed over. But she answered with, "Yes'm," her first line. She managed to utter the next few, hoping she got them in the right order, before scampering like a dog with its tail between its legs back to the safety of the wings. The soldiers roared with laughter. Backstage, Betty Lou gave her a pat on the shoulder. "Not bad." The show continued. The other members of the cast were loud and confident, especially Maxine, who was a force of nature as the psychic Madame Arcati. The two male parts were played by men, presumably soldiers who'd volunteered. Each time Hazel ventured out, she relaxed a little more. When she wasn't on stage, she watched the eager faces of the soldiers in the first few rows. The men were desperate for entertainment, for something else to think about besides the war. And even when the rain began falling in sheets, no one stirred. Unfortunately, in spite of the men's rapt attention, her performance was far from perfect. She stepped in the other girls' lines instead of waiting her turn to speak, and missed a couple of entrances. But she'd done it. She'd acted on a stage in front of people. Terribly, no doubt about that, but as the men whooped and whistled during the curtain call, Hazel managed a proud smile. "Up and at 'em, ladies!" Verna's voice boomed across the pup tent. Hazel groaned and sat upright. After being driven back to the base the night before, Hazel had skipped dinner and retreated to her assigned cot, the exhaustion from her journey and the sheer terror of performing having caught up with her. Sure, she'd stunk last night in the show, but what had they expected with no rehearsals? Better to come clean. Try to start fresh. "Listen, everyone, I'm sorry about how awful I was. I didn't expect to go on stage so soon." "Don't worry about it," Betty Lou's voice came out, a sweet squeak. "We all had a period of adjustment. It's to be expected."
"Yeah," agreed Verna. "The thing about this gig is that you'll get a do-over. And another. And another."
"I'm so sick of Blythe spirit." Phyllis yanked a stocking over a thick thigh. Everything about Phyllis was solid and grandmotherly, even though she couldn't have been more than 30 years old. "The men love it, but they love anything. What's the schedule today?"
Verna looked up at a ragged calendar posted on the bulletin board. "We're off this morning, then shows at 4 and 8.
"I'm serious," Betty Lou put her hands over her face. "I can't do this play again. Please don't make me."
Maybe there was something Hazel could do to make up for last night. She pulled her suitcase out from under her cot and popped it open. Digging through the dresses, she found the book she was looking for and held it up.
"I brought this with me. 12 Best American Plays from 1936 to 1937. Maybe one of these will work instead."
Betty Lou let out a shriek.
"Amen! I thought we'd be waiting another month for a new script. Now we have 12. Maxine, look!"
Maxine, who'd been uncharacteristically subdued, reading a book on her cot, swung her legs over the side. "Let's see." Hazel tossed it over. "Not bad." Maxine thumbed through it. "We can work with this. Good job, Hayseed." Hazel refused to let that nickname stick.
"Look, I really don't want to be called Hayseed during my tour. I've paid my dues."
"In what way?"
"Well, I've worked on Broadway since 1939.
Maxine studied her. "Why don't I remember you, then? When I lived in New York, I went to everything.
I was an understudy."
"Huh. Did you ever go on?" Hazel swallowed.
"No."
Wait a minute. Verna snapped her fingers. I heard about you. Didn't you understudy for something like 24 shows and never once perform? She didn't wait for an answer, not that Hazel wanted to give her one. That's right. The producers loved you because the audiences were never disappointed. It was in the Post. Hazel's mother had read the article aloud the day it came out, while Hazel's ears burned with embarrassment. What a shame, Ruth had said. You standing in the sidelines while real actresses like Faye Ray and Betty Furness get the spotlight. Seriously, Hazel, your brother would have been very disappointed. A man's voice called out from the other side of the tense flap door. The facilities are ready for you, ladies. Hazel, relieved by the interruption, followed the girls outside, clutching her helmet and a towel. They were led to the washing area, where a board with circular cutouts lay across two wooden horses. The women stuck their helmets under the faucet and filled them with water before laying them in the holes, a kind of makeshift sink. Hazel washed her face and hands and brushed her teeth before dumping out the water and wiping the inside of her helmet with a towel. She'd hoped that she'd have the morning to get her bearings around the camp, but instead was told to report back to Naples to fill out more paperwork, with Maxine assigned to accompany her. She wished it had been one of the others. Hazel held tight as the jeep careened back toward Naples over roads that were no better than those in the Dark Ages must have been. Above the narrow streets, laundry hung limply from precarious-looking balconies. They took a right, coming to a small plaza where a crowd blocked the way. "What's going on?" asked Maxine. The driver stood up to get a better look. "Stay here, in the jeep." He climbed out and was soon swallowed by the crowd. Hazel and Maxine pulled themselves to standing to get a better view. The focal point of attention seemed to be a beautiful, very pale boy with full cheeks, his blonde hair swept off to one side. For a moment, Hazel almost called out her brother's name. The resemblance was uncanny. Even the way the boy tossed his head to get his hair out of his eyes was the same. When her brother used to do that, girls swooned. But no, it wasn't Ben. This kid was too young, for one, and when he turned his head, the profile wasn't quite right, the nose slightly turned up at the tip. He had one arm flung around a slightly older boy, sporting the beginnings of a mustache, who seemed to be near tears. The swarm pushed in, jostling the boys closer together. The blonde boy looked defiant, his light complexion a stark contrast to that of his olive-skinned companion. A rock flew out of nowhere and struck the blonde in the forehead. He winced, but didn't speak or cry out. A shock of red blood oozed from just below his hairline. Hazel gasped, shielding the sun with her hand for a better view of the scene. Why are they attacking them? An old Italian woman standing next to the jeep, her head covered by a green paisley scarf, answered in accented English, "They were caught trying to steal bicycles. One refuses to speak, probably a German. The other, a collaboratore." "Jesus," said Maxine, "what will happen to them?" "They die." The woman spit on the ground before allowing herself to be sucked forward with the surge of the mob like liquid mercury. Hazel tried to spot their driver. He'd made it about halfway to the boys, but the pack had tightened and wasn't responding to his commands to step aside. Hazel pointed to a group of kids who were collecting rocks from the rubble of a bombed-out wall. "They're going to stone them to death!" This primitive system of justice outraged Hazel, but the energy emanating from the crowd was like a living, breathing monster, unstoppable. The blonde boy seemed resigned to his fate, but held on tightly to his friend as others tried to pull them apart. The dark-haired one shook his head, tears streaming down his face, as a man near the edge of the crowd lifted an enormous cement block above his head and, staggering under its weight, headed in the direction of the boys. In one swift motion, Maxine climbed over to the front seat of the jeep and slid behind the wheel. She laid hard on the horn, shifted the gears, and gunned the engine. Hazel clutched the side of the jeep and stifled a scream as Maxine drove forward. This was madness, driving straight into danger. Distracted by the horn, the crowd parted, some of them barely stepping out of the way in time. Their driver, who'd finally made it to the boys, looked up and spotted the vehicle.
The look of relief on his face was quickly replaced by an angry snarl directed at the Neapolitans around him. He grabbed both boys by the scruff of their jackets, like a couple of puppies, and yanked them in the direction of the jeep. As Maxine tumbled back into the rear seat, revealing a flash of pale upper thigh, a man standing at Hazel's elbow said something in Italian and tried to reach inside. Hazel swatted him off and gave him a good thunk on the forehead with the meat of her palm for good measure. Finally, the driver got close enough to shove the dark-haired boy into the front passenger seat and the blonde one next to them in the back before taking the wheel. He reversed up the street to a crossing, executed a quick turn, and sped away. Hazel breathed in great gulps of air, thankful to be free, as the dark-haired boy sobbed into his hands. The blonde one, grimacing, allowed Maxine to dab at his forehead with a handkerchief. Maxine said something quietly under her breath, and the boy, eyes wide, responded in kind. In German. The suspicions of the crowd had been correct. Hazel leaned over. "You speak German?" Maxine addressed Hazel without taking her eyes off the boy. "My grandmother is German. I learned some from her." No one with German or Italian parents was allowed to audition for the USO tour. Hazel supposed grandparents were all right, although she doubted Maxine would have been crazy enough to volunteer that information. Hazel noticed the driver watching them closely in the rearview mirror. The rest of the ride, the boy spoke fast and furiously, Maxine interrupting every so often to ask a question. "What is he saying?" Hazel couldn't wait any longer. Maxine spoke loudly so the driver could hear as well. "His name is Paul. His father was a senior colonel in the German army who sent for him and his mother to join him in Calabria early in the war. I don't think the woman was married to him, more of a mistress. Paul befriended this Italian boy, Matteo, he's called, and says they both worked with the Italian resistance against the Germans." "Against his own father?" Hazel glanced ahead at the driver, who remained stone-faced. "That's what Paul says. He and his mother were left behind, abandoned by his father when the German army retreated. His mother was killed soon after. Paul went into hiding, protected by his friend's family." The German boy addressed Maxine again. She nodded. "He says he can prove that he was part of the resistance if they reach out to Matteo's father." Matteo nodded.
"Mio padre, in Calabria."
"What are they doing here in Naples?" Hazel asked. "It was becoming too dangerous in the countryside. Matteo's family was threatened, so the two boys ran off to try to make it to the Americans in Naples. The idea was for Paul to turn himself in and explain his story. They stole bikes and traveled by night, until they got caught." They pulled up at a large square called the Piazza Municipio, ringed on three sides by official-looking buildings in a deep ochre. If their story were true, the boys had made it to safety, just barely. But Hazel had a suspicion that they weren't in the clear just yet, as did they, judging from their terrified faces. Maxine addressed the driver.
"What happens to them now?"
"I'll take care of them. You go up this way."
The driver nodded toward an arched doorway.
"Through there."
The German boy grabbed Maxine's arm and rattled off something fast.
"He says he's only 15, that he never hurt anyone."
The driver gave her a dark look.
"He's a prisoner, not a pet."
They had no choice but to watch as the boys were driven off. But Maxine and the German boy locked eyes until the jeep rounded the corner and disappeared. Inside, Hazel filled out her paperwork in triplicate, while Maxine explained to the major in charge what had happened, trying to convince him to look further into the situation.
"The German one, Paul, says he was brought here when he was just 11, said Maxine, "and that he can prove that he's been part of the resistance if you reach out to the father of the other boy."
The major barely contained the scorn in his voice.
"What makes you think you can trust some German kid? Take his words at face value. He's just trying to save his hide. Probably a regular soldier who got stuck behind enemy lines. They'll say anything to stay alive."
"He's too young to have been a soldier. After all, the Germans retreated 2 years ago. Will you at least look into his story?"
Maxine's bravery in the square, as well as now with the major, astonished Hazel. She wished she were that brash, but she wouldn't dare question an authority figure.
Always the understudy, in life as well as in art. The thought smarted. The major didn't answer Maxine's question.
You said you spoke German to him?
Maxine responded with a barely perceptible nod. My grandmother is German, but she's lived in America forever. She has nothing to do with the old country.
Huh. Don't go anywhere. I have to check something.
He disappeared into a back room. Hazel looked over at Maxine, whose face had turned white. Are you all right? Let's hope they don't haul me off, too. She laughed, but it didn't reach her eyes. I couldn't help it. They were so young. Just boys. The haunted look on Maxine's face stirred Hazel's memory. She'd seen a woman on her brother's arm wearing a similar expression years ago. That must be why Maxine looked so familiar. Her brother had dated a striking redhead for a couple of months, whom Hazel had met only briefly. The realization almost knocked the wind out of her. Did you know my brother back in New York? The more she studied Maxine, the more convinced she became. You did, I'm sure of it. I saw you with him a couple of times. What on earth are you talking about? The color had crept back into Maxine's face, and her usual look of annoyance had returned. My brother was named Ben Ripley. I'm sure I remember him introducing you around to his gang at a coffee shop downtown, his friends joking that you were way above his pay grade, and another time when we were all at a demonstration in New York. Something against fascism, I'm pretty sure. Or maybe against the Spanish War. There were so many protests back then. Along with her brother and all of their friends, Hazel had marched practically every weekend, signed every petition, anything to stop the wave of authoritarianism sweeping the world. Ben had shown up to one rally with the exotic-looking redhead. The crowd had been rowdy, and after a short while, the girl had yanked Ben away. Hazel hadn't seen her since. Maxine cocked her head. I dated a guy named Ben, an actor, for a New York minute. You're his sister? I am. I knew it. That's where I know you from. It's been bugging me since I arrived. For a moment, the boys in the square were forgotten. Maxine let out a bark of a laugh. Ben Ripley. Sure thing. I thought we were going out for a picnic in the park, but the guy dragged me to some demonstration. I couldn't get out of there fast enough. He was way too full of himself for me. Still is, I'm guessing. Hazel wasn't sure how to respond. She shook her head. Even though it had been 3 years, the words never came out right. No. Not anymore. Chapter 2. Hazel. April 1945. Maxine stayed silent for a moment before putting her arm around Hazel. Oh, God, I'm so sorry. My big mouth. Hazel finally got the words out. Ben was killed soon after he enlisted. In a plane crash. If I remember, he was a talented guy, right? What an understatement. Ben had been the boy wonder, a natural mimic. He took after their dad, a former vaudeville star brought down by a stroke when Hazel was 12. Ben, always up for a challenge, had entertained their father, enlisting Hazel as his stooge in skits that made him laugh, although it only showed on the good side of his face. Even before their father's stroke, it was assumed that Ben and Hazel would go into acting, that the Ripley name would carry on through the children. After all, this was the family legacy. While other families passed down a dry-cleaning business or a hardware store, their inheritance was their father's brilliance in the footlights, and his name. From the fading glory of their vast Upper West Side apartment, where scripts and old newspapers littered the living room, Ben, older by 3 years, worked on auditions and scenes for his acting classes. Hazel dutifully signed up for the same ones as soon as she graduated from high school. Ruth, who had managed her husband's career from the very beginning and liked to take full credit for his success, was determined that the family become as famous as the Astaires or the Lunts. The Ripleys of West End Avenue, she'd proclaim. The first time Hazel performed a scene in acting class, she worked on the role with her mother until late the night before. Her head spinning from exhaustion, yet jittery with excitement, Hazel had waited with her scene partner as the teacher, An elderly Russian man with wild hairs sprouting from his ears and nose reminisced for a good 5 minutes on Ben's uncanny take on O'Neill before allowing Hazel and her scene partner to proceed. From the corner of her eye, she'd noticed the instructor slumping farther and farther into his seat as they stumbled through the scene, which made her forget all the coaching her mother had given her. Once they'd finished, the instructor had focused all his commentary on her acting partner before dismissing Hazel with a mere 3 sentences.
"That was a perfectly fine interpretation of the scene. The problem with fine is that it's boring. You bored us."
While she knew she wasn't the best actress in the room and had a lot to learn, it wasn't fair to compare her first attempt with that of her brother after 3 years of intensive study. Hazel had scurried out as soon as class was over to avoid the sympathetic yet gleeful looks of her classmates. She'd been resigned to living in the shadows ever since. But her brand of boring appealed to producers casting for understudies. They preferred a chameleon who'd blend seamlessly into the production, who wouldn't dare tamper with the blocking or line readings in an effort to outshine the star. Secretly, Hazel didn't mind waiting in the wings, watching the best scenes before retreating to the understudy's dressing room with a good book. But to say so out loud would tarnish her father's legacy as well as her brother's lost dreams. She had to do more, be more. She'd first heard about the USO tour from a couple of actors at the counter of Hanson's Drugstore on Broadway, where she was killing time before slinking home after yet another pointless understudy rehearsal. She'd signed up to audition for the tour on a whim, figuring that it would make her parents happy to see their daughter follow in Ben's footsteps, both on the stage and in service to the country. How wrong she'd been. Her mother had hated the very idea, terrified that she'd lose her daughter as well as her son, and said she prayed each night that Hazel would be rejected. The day that Hazel was to depart on her tour, she'd stepped into the kitchen wearing her uniform, only to see the ghost of Ben reflected in her mother's eyes. Her father's naturally lopsided countenance slid into a grimace as her mother ran from the room, one hand clutching her mouth as if she was about to be sick. No matter what Hazel did, it turned out terribly. Maxine rubbed Hazel's back. "Sorry to have spoken ill of your brother. I barely knew him." The major returned, accompanied by a wiry man with a pipe sticking out of his mouth. Maxine and Hazel exchanged looks. No doubt Maxine had overstepped her place by advocating for the two boys.
"Which one of you speaks kraut?"
asked the wiry man. Maxine raised her hand, as though they were in elementary school. To see Maxine cowed made Hazel even more nervous.
"Come with me, both of you."
As they walked deeper into the building, the man introduced himself as Colonel Peterson, the head of radio programming.
"We're in charge of all the music the soldiers listen to, as well as propaganda broadcasts. That's where you come in. What's your name again?"
Maxine introduced herself, then added, "And this is Hazel Ripley."
"Maxine, huh? This way."
The colonel didn't even look at Hazel, but she was used to that by now, and she'd already noticed that being in close proximity to Maxine was the equivalent to disappearing into thin air. They entered a small, soundproofed room where a microphone sat on a desk next to some fancy equipment with lots of dials. The colonel picked up a bundle of papers.
"The soldier who's been doing the propaganda broadcasts got transferred, and we've been looking for a German speaker to fill in. Radio waves, unlike newspapers or television broadcasts, aren't deterred by borders or front lines, which gives us a direct line of communication with the enemy population. You're a girl, but I figure it might be even better that way."
"What exactly do you want me to do?" asked Maxine.
"Make your voice nice and pretty, and read off this list of German POWs."
He pointed to a single piece of paper beside the microphone. "Then say that the boys are safe and sound, in German. Once that's done, pick some articles from these." He tossed down a few copies of The Stars and Stripes,
"and condense it for a German audience."
"Condense it? I'm not sure I understand." He pointed to a headline.
Choose three or four articles that emphasize American values, American strength, and summarize them. We want to plant doubt in their minds. Make them wonder if the Führer is not all that he's cracked up to be, if they're not being told the whole truth.
Right. Maxine didn't sound convinced. I'll take these back to camp with me and figure out what to say.
You don't go anywhere. First broadcast is today, as soon as you're ready. If you do a good job, we'll have you on once a week.
What on earth? I can't just speak off the cuff. I have to have something in front of me to read. I'm an actress. I need lines.
The colonel wasn't listening. We'll call you Lena aus America.
His accent was terrible.
Lena from America. Don't make it too heavy-handed. No calls for surrender, no ridicule. We're just reinforcing what they know deep down, that they're on the losing side. Got it?
He didn't wait for an answer.
I'll be back in 30 minutes. But we've got to get back for a show.
The door slammed before Maxine could finish the sentence. She stared after him aghast.
I can't do it. What do I talk about?
Hazel grabbed the newspaper and picked up a pen. I can help you, and if we get this right, we'll be back next week. That'll give us a chance to find out more about the boys. Maybe we can reach someone higher up who'll listen to us.
Good point.
They sat down together at the table, studying the front page. This one's all about the dive bombing of rail bridges in northern Italy, backed by ground forces, said Hazel. I'll strip out the basic ideas for you and write them down, so it's a condensed version.
Maxine nodded. Great. Then I'll just translate it off the page.
What about this one? It says that the British forces are 15 miles from Hamburg, which is Germany's largest port.
Sure, that'll work.
Reader's Digest's got nothing on you.
Writing so fast on the fly made Hazel's heart race. Figuring out how to pare down a complicated sentence, or simply racking her brain to find the right word, was a mental challenge, like memorizing lines, but more interesting. They'd summarized 3 articles by the time the colonel came back into the room with a technician.
Remember, keep it light and pretty, he said, as the technician handed Maxine a set of headphones. Lean in close to the microphone.
Hazel held her breath as Maxine read through the list of POW names, her voice soothing and calm in spite of the guttural German consonants. She stumbled on the commentary for the 2nd news item and glanced over in panic. Hazel gave a nod of encouragement, and Maxine kept on, the abrasive sounds of the language mellowed by her delivery. After the last news item was announced, Maxine said a few lines in German, then signed off with a kiss.
Danke fürs Zuhören.
They tiptoed outside the room as the technician put on a record. The colonel beamed down at Maxine.
Well done. Come back next week, same time.
He looked her up and down. Maybe we'll get some photos taken, fire them over the lines so they can get a long, sweet look at our girl Lena. This could really be something big.
I'm thrilled you're pleased. Maxine drew close. Maybe you could do something for me.
She went on to describe the story of the boys they'd rescued on their way into town.
We were hoping you could follow up, make sure they're properly seen to, in case it turns out that they did work for the resistance. It would mean the world if you could inquire.
I suppose I can look into it. A German and an Italian, you say?
Yes, Paul and Matteo.
Fine, fine.
He took his leave, even shaking Hazel's hand.
See you gals in a week.
Out in the bright sunshine of the plaza, Maxine let out a deep laugh. Hazel couldn't help but join in from relief. Maxine elbowed Hazel in the ribs.
I couldn't have pulled it off without you. Looks like Lena aus America's new fans are getting 2 girls in 1 package. I'll be her voice, and you'll be her brains.
To think that 24 hours earlier, Hazel had written off Maxine as a bossy witch. Now they were linked as comrades in arms. She hoped her brother had made a similar friend in the short time before his death.
You look a little wiped out.
Maxine led her to a fountain where a trident-wielding Neptune stood watch over lions that, before the bombing, had spewed streams of water. Instead, their empty mouths gaped as if they were uttering silent roars at the destruction of their city.
Let's sit over here a minute. Hazel scanned the streets. Their ride was nowhere in sight. I hope we make it back in time for the show. The soldiers will still be waiting, no matter how late we show up. The giddy bubbles of relief slowly faded, replaced by the memory of the angry mob earlier that afternoon. Hazel spoke quietly. Do you think the colonel will follow up like he said? I don't know. Hopefully we'll have more news next week. Maxine waved an arm out in front of her. Every person here has a story, and most of them will probably end more pitifully than the ones we got a glimpse of today. Children dying of hunger while their mothers watch, unable to help. The world is a horrible place, and in the frenzy to be right, to force their will, these armies trample over each other. Trust me, I've been out here since last year, and the one thing I've learned is that we're all at the mercy of the powers that be. Maxine's view was so tragic, Hazel couldn't agree. She got the distinct impression that under the grand speechifying lurked the same fear for the boy's safety that gnawed at Hazel. Once Hitler is stopped, and all the newspapers say that might be any day now, we'll be able to right all these wrongs, she insisted. Fix what was broken. Take care of the children. As the jeep pulled up, Maxine stood and straightened Hazel's tie. Enough with all this gosh-shucks optimism, Hayseed. For now, you just worry about not missing your entrance cue again. A week later, the news broke that Hitler had committed suicide, lifting the spirits of the soldiers. But Hazel detected a hesitancy behind the celebrations. The war in the Pacific was still raging, and no doubt the troops would soon be shipped east to join in the battle against Japan. Even after 4 long years of war in Europe, the fighting wasn't over. The Book of Plays had warmed Hazel's welcome among the actresses, to her grateful delight. During the next week, they rehearsed in the mornings, filling in the men's roles with soldiers who had some acting experience and often learned their lines faster than the professionals. Hazel's confidence grew with every show. Her knees stopped quaking before she stepped out on stage, and she could be present, in the moment, for most of her scenes. As the latest addition to their motley troupe, she didn't get the leading roles, but that was fine with her. Better to have Maxine or Betty Lou garner the loudest applause at the curtain call. Not that it was perfect. She noticed that sometimes Maxine went off the deep end, overplaying her lines. But the men loved it when she swaggered about with a sing-song cadence, even if it had very little to do with the character she was portraying. Betty Lou often forgot what she was supposed to say next, but she shrugged it off with a good-natured squeal, while Verna had an annoying tendency to drift too far upstage. At least half the soldiers had never seen a legitimate play and were intrigued by the whole concept. With an average age of 26 and a hunger for drama, they reminded Hazel of what she'd read about Shakespeare's audiences, the groundlings, who stood out in all weather and had no qualms about letting their enthusiasm rip. The USO Tours sets were basic, with scenery painted on fabrics that could be easily switched out between shows and the minimum number of stage props. Yet for a few hours, there was no doubt the men were instead imagining the grand interior of an English manor house or a tiny village in Andalusia. When Maxine and Hazel arrived back in Naples a week later, Colonel Peterson was in a good mood, Lena's propaganda broadcast having pleased his superiors immensely. Once they'd wrapped up the session, he shook both their hands. "Well done, ladies. Glad you enjoyed it," said Maxine. "Now, can you tell us any news about the boys? You know, from last week?" The colonel hesitated a beat before explaining that the Italian one was on his way back home, accompanied by 2 soldiers who would inquire into the validity of the German story. The German, he said, was being held in a jail 2 blocks away so the Americans could interview him further. If he truly was the son of a high-ranking officer, as he claimed, he could be valuable. "What if Maxine offered to help interview him, since she knows German?" said Hazel. Maxine jumped in. "Right, I'd be happy to help." "Sure, sure, we'll let you know." A dismissal, if ever Hazel heard one. Normally she'd back off, cowed by his authority, but she couldn't acquiesce this time. What if Paul had a sister back in Germany, one who wondered what had happened to him, or if he was safe? A sister who would never get an answer, not if he was chewed up by the maddening bureaucracy of the war. It didn't help that, every night, the image of a blonde boy flicking his hair out of his eyes emerged like a ghost in Hazel's dreams. Sometimes it turned out to be her brother, sometimes Paul.
"We made a strong connection with the boy," said Hazel. "We would really like to assist."
"I can see that. You've made yourselves clear."
The colonel reached out and shook their hands.
"In the meantime, thank you. Lena was a big hit, and we appreciate your service."
"I'm sorry, do you mean that you don't need Lena anymore?"
Hazel exchanged looks with Maxine.
"Hitler's dead. There's no point. The German soldiers know it's over."
The colonel popped a pipe into his mouth with one hand and lit a match with the other, waving the flame over the tobacco before inhaling deeply. The smoke ghosted up over his face, obscuring his features for a moment. Without the broadcasts, there'd be no excuse to return to headquarters. Hazel racked her brain.
"Well, what about the American soldiers? What if we do something for them?"
"Like what?"
The colonel took another long drag on his pipe.
"What about we profile a soldier each week, talk about where he comes from, that kind of thing?"
She sensed Maxine nodding beside her, encouraging her.
"I'll write it, and Maxine can read it, as herself, not Lena, to cheer our boys up and do our part to support the war effort."
The colonel looked over at Maxine.
"I guess we could try it." "What the hell? Go ahead, write something up and come back next week. If I like it, you can broadcast it."
Maxine squeezed her arm as they exited the building.
"Quick thinking, Hazel."
"I hope I can pull it off," said Hazel, settling on a bench to wait for their ride back.
"What do you mean? You flew through those write-ups for Lena. That was just rewriting. Here I have to come up with something from scratch. I'm an actress, not a writer."
"You kidding? You're our secret weapon. Besides, I know tons of writers, and they all feel the same way you do, that they're not up to snuff. Goes along with the territory."
"How do you know tons of writers?"
"From when I was in New York, living at the Chelsea Hotel."
"That's the one on 23rd, right?"
"Yes, exactly. It's full of artists and people like us. A Shangri-La for new bohemians. You can't turn a corner without running into a poet or a playwright or a novelist. The place is simply bursting with wordsmiths." She counted on her fingers. "Thomas Wolfe, Edgar Lee Masters. Trust me, you're just as good as they are." Maxine was being generous, but Hazel appreciated the support. The idea of a hotel filled with creative types was certainly appealing.
"How long did you stay there?"
"A couple of years. There's an actress named Lavinia Smarts who brought me into the fold. She's like the den mother of the place."
"I've heard of her. She's an amazing talent."
"Sure is." Hazel sighed.
"I just wish there was something more we could do to help Paul. The colonel didn't seem very interested in us getting involved."
"Well, since our ride back to camp is nowhere in sight, how about we take a quick walk?" Maxine gave her a long look. "He said the jail was only a couple of blocks away." They asked the guard out front for directions and hustled over as fast as they could. An Italian soldier stood at the entrance of a massive three-story building dotted with small barred windows. Maxine explained, in a mixture of mime, English, and a few words of Italian, that they wanted to see the Tedesco, the German. The Italian soldier didn't speak much English, but by making the universal sign for a bottle of beer, made his point clear. Maxine promised to bring some alcohol back the next week, although Hazel wasn't sure how she'd pull that off. As they walked away, Maxine glanced back, then gripped Hazel's arm hard.
"Look."
Hazel turned around and followed Maxine's finger. A pale face stared down at them from the third floor, hands tight around the bars of the window. "Paul." They waved with both arms, and he responded with a lift of his chin and a wave of his own before retreating from view. They couldn't explain that they'd be back or that they were trying to help, but at least he'd seen them. Paul's defiance, his proud bearing, reminded Hazel so much of Ben, but she didn't want to think about that. That evening at dinner, the soldiers had a surprise waiting for the acting troupe. As the men clapped and whistled, the five actresses were escorted to a table in the middle of the mess tent that had been laid with a white tablecloth, a bouquet of flowers, and cloth napkins. Hazel turned beet red, but the other girls whistled right back.
"What's all this for?" asked Maxine.
"For reminding us of our girls back home," said one of the men. "For giving us hope."
Hazel looked about. So many of these men had never ventured out of their small towns before they were shipped off, and she could imagine the depths of their homesickness. How horrible it must have been when their idealized versions of the war, of heroic feats and brotherly love, were twisted by reality into fatigue, hunger, and grisly sights that would never fade from their memories. After dinner, the women sat around the table, now joined by 10 or so soldiers, and a young kid with a sketch pad who offered to do caricatures of the men.
"Who is that?" Hazel asked Betty Lou.
"Floyd. He was sent over, like we were, to entertain the troops."
"With art?"
"You should see him. He can whip up a portrait in no time. I kept mine. I'm going to frame it when I'm home. He gave me a waist to die for."
Hazel laughed.
The boy had red pimples on his forehead, while his feet and hands were way too big for his thin frame.
"He looks like he's about 12.
Kid's got a gift."
The boy ripped a page from his pad and handed it to Maxine. She held it up so the rest of them could see. In the drawing, her curves were slightly exaggerated, but not enough to be crass, and her red hair cascaded down her shoulders like a waterfall of lava. She came off as voluptuous and tough, her lips pursed together and her eyes peering off to the side as if a lover had just walked into the room. Hazel's attention was soon taken up by the man to her right, who hailed from Kansas. He talked so fast, sometimes she wasn't sure what he was saying, but that didn't seem to matter to him at all. Something about sending home letters to his girl, and did she think she'd still be waiting for him?
"Of course. What's your girl's name?" Hazel asked.
"Eileen. I write to her every week without fail, but I haven't heard from her in 3 months. Do you think I've done something wrong? Or maybe she hasn't gotten my letters and thinks I'm dead. I don't know if I could stand that."
Hazel thought of her brother, who hadn't had a girl back home, who hadn't had time to send even one letter to his family before they got word of his death. Her mother had opened the door to the two men in uniform and brought them into the living room, where Hazel sat reading to her father in his wheelchair. She remembered thinking that she hoped the soldiers weren't shocked by what they saw, the scripts and books lying about, the missing button on her father's cardigan, the dust motes dancing in the sunlight. That's what she remembered most about that moment, the dust motes, as she willed the men not to speak.
"Benny's all right, yes?"
Her mother's chin wobbled. They'd launched into a prepared speech, said he'd been killed in a plane crash behind enemy lines, said that he had not survived, said that he was a hero.
"Where did it happen?" Ruth asked.
"We're not at liberty to say, ma'am," answered one of them.
"Was it quick?"
"Yes, ma'am."
But Hazel could tell the answer was a lie. They didn't know the circumstances any more than she and her parents did. It was all a haze, like the stifling air inside the room. The family came apart without Ben. He was the glue, the silly clown, the sweet prince that Ruth doted on. Hazel's father didn't show much emotion, and his disability made it difficult in any event. But Ruth emoted enough for the three of them put together. Except for once at the wake, when Hazel looked up from pouring out cups of coffee to see her mother studying her intently, her eyes clear and dry.
"I guess you'll do. God help us," Ruth had said, before retreating into the living room to weep in the arms of strangers.
As if he'd picked up on her thoughts, the boy from Kansas began to tear up. Hazel shifted her chair closer, asking him questions to distract him from the girl Eileen. About his favorite K-rations, and what made him laugh. What were his favorite films? Who did he look up to and admire? As they talked, she realized that this was how she could create the soldier hero for the broadcast, by interviewing the men and summing up their stories of bravery and humility. She couldn't wait to get back to the tent, pull out her notebook, and jot down some notes from the conversation.
"Hey, look, Hazel!"
Verna pointed from across the table.
"Floyd's done you, too."
Hazel hadn't even noticed the kid had pulled up a chair nearby. He carefully ripped the paper from the pad and handed it over. He'd gotten the basics right, her shoulder-length blonde hair with its curled tips, her blue eyes and arched eyebrows, which she had to pencil in. Unlike Maxine's portrait, hers was not even a caricature, because nothing about her stood out. What surprised her was that she didn't mind, really. The work she and Maxine were doing for the Army, as well as their personal mission to get justice for Paul, was suddenly bigger and more vibrant than anything else in Hazel's life. She had never been the type of girl to fixate on her appearance, but now it was an afterthought at best. She was far more interested in what she was doing than what she looked like. She smiled and thanked the boy for his drawing, rolling it up just as Maxine wandered over, carrying a box that clinked as she carefully set it down. Their bribe had been procured.
Chapter 3. Maxine. May 7th, 1945. We managed to get into the jail to see the boy, Paul. They locked us inside his tiny cell with him while we talked, probably to keep us safe from the other prisoners, whose shouts and whistles echoed off the stone walls. Right after we got back to camp, I dictated the basics of the conversation to Hazel, and we sent it off to the colonel, convincing one of the drivers to hand-deliver it today. Now, we wait. But I can't get him out of my head. Our report didn't say everything, like how the Italian guard eyed me up and down as I handed over the bottles of beer, and how glad I was to have Hazel next to me at that moment, that the cell Paul was kept in smelled like rancid meat. So I'm writing it down myself. I have to, or I'll go mad with the waiting. We're not supposed to keep diaries, but I have to get these images out of my head and onto the page, so they don't haunt me anymore. Inside his dingy cell, Paul talked with great detail, straining to make the story as vivid as possible, knowing that Hazel and I were most likely the only people who cared what happened to him. The report didn't say that the first thing he did was pull out a ragged photo of his mother from his pocket. The words, Greta, age 28, scribbled on the back. She had pale hair and eyes and looked like a ghost, and he told me of his father's cruelty, how the beatings were more frequent as the German forces lost their hold. Greta disappeared 2 days after they'd been abandoned by his father, having gone out to find them some food. Rumor was she'd been drowned in the river by some villagers, held down until she stopped squirming. Paul had sought shelter in the home of his friend, Matteo, and they'd hidden him away, kept him safe. The report didn't talk about the stretches of boredom as he cowered in the basement, staying quiet when a neighbor dropped by unexpectedly, of playing card games with Matteo to pass the time, of their deepening friendship, and how worried he was that Matteo wouldn't be delivered home safely from Naples. Before, when the Germans were in control, Paul would